I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Marina, I wanted to start by asking you a bit about your personal discovery of art. I think you grew up just outside of Cambridge, 5 miles away from Cambridge. And you write in your preface about your discovery of Kettle's Yard, and I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that.
Yes, well, this actually, someone who worked at Kettle's Yard is here tonight, so I'm Roger Melbert, who's been very helpful to me in the whole creation of these essays. But so Kettle's Yard is an absolutely remarkable place. I'm sure many of you know, but there was a man called Jim Eade, and he'd made friends particularly with Gaudia Breschka and Sophie Gaudia Breschka, and had actually looked after them a bit. And that was the core of the collection in this series of tiny cottages, or perhaps two cottages, which he had built, put together. But the remarkable thing about his collecting was that he saw art as a complete continuum with life. It was a slightly Bauhaus idea, so that everything, it wasn't just the enshrined object of great, you know, beauty on the walls, but the whole of the interior was a continuum. But above all, much more striking than that, he held open house. And I was taken by a friend who was an undergraduate at Cambridge, because we were living nearby. I was not yet an undergraduate, I was still at school. And introduced, and I felt particularly for Gaudia Breschka, who seemed to me, and I think it's very important actually in my whole relationship to art, he seemed to me to have a quality of being able to abstract the passion and the idea and the image, if you like. I mean, the swallowing of fish image, that fantastic sculpture, is both an abstraction and a sort of distillation, as well as a very, very dynamic representation of the act of swallowing a fish. So there's that in a sense is, I suppose, you know, where my interest, my sort of fascination lies, is how you can make the language of visual imagery work at this second level, where it's actually compressing meaning, making it much more intense and powerful. I mean, I suppose that you might say that's a definition of making art, but it's the symbolic level that interests me.
Again, in your really striking preface, you write about the anthropologist Alfred Gell, who has written, to write about art at all is in fact to write about either religion or the substitute for religion. I think as a child you went to a Catholic boarding school, and I wanted to ask how you think your Catholic upbringing has impacted on your understanding of art and relationship with art. That's quite a big question.
Yes,
I know,
No, it's just that it's always quite hard to own up to these things, partly because they do go so very deep. Though I think that a lot of the kind of thinking and writing I've tried to do has actually emancipated me to some extent. So I'm not quite as much of a Catholic as I was when I was a child. But but certainly the cult of images dominated my childhood. Mm. So when I discovered Alfred Gell's work, it made sense to me retrospectively of my relationship with statues. I used to walk around the gardens at school. I was at a boarding school, which were filled with statues of the Virgin Mary. And I'd think if I just took three steps and then turned quickly, I'd see her move. and, 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 you know, I would catch her smiling or crying or something, because it was so saturated, the stories of this idea of the living statue. And there are many wonderful legends, which I'm sure many of you know, because they've become operas and all kinds of things, in which, you know, a youth will pledge love to the statue of the Virgin Mary, but then he's unfaithful to her because he takes a bride, and she comes down into his bedroom and plucks him, you know, to her breast, and that's it. So this idea of the living image, which Alfred Gell puts in an anthropological context, he did his art historical work as an anthropologist in New Zealand and Papua New Guinea, and he was interested in how, as indeed Gombrich and Abby Warburg are, he was interested in how art was an active part of the community's self-preservation. And this would be not just made images, representations, but it would be dances and social activities together that would create objects and artifacts that were beautiful in the light of the people making them, but also to the light of stranger observers like himself. And so this idea that beauty was being activated to serve the interests of the community of the group, he said that was the principle in his book, Art as Agency, that was the principle that we could look at contemporary art and the making of art in the West as well. He said that the sort of mimetic theories, that you paint a beautiful landscape merely to represent it more profoundly, more deeply, actually missed this particular active agency of the made image, which was a secular power as well as a religious power. And that, I think, is probably the main drift of the argument of my book. Mm. And oddly enough, it actually relates very to a very early experience I had, which is that when I was an undergraduate, Edgar Vint was the Slade professor at Oxford, and he came and gave some lectures on the Sistine Chapel with glass slides. You know, it was amazing to see these glass slides. I mean, they were very state-of-the-art and beautifully detailed. And he gave this hugely kind of deep interpretation of the meaning of the paintings, frescoes. And I came out with a friend of mine. We were both interested in art. And I said, that's just terrible. He just thinks that art is all about the content and the stories. Art is about form and line and color. Because I was at that stage had been raised on this aesthetic modernism. But I was absolutely converted. I mean, I had been converted by Vint, that art is actually full of content, and it's actually full of ideology, and it is telling you the story of the sacred narrative of salvation. I mean, it can do that. And therefore, we need to pay, in a sense, more alert attention, you know, because it's actually doing things to us. It's not just a kind of beautiful evocation or perhaps troubling evocation of a nude. It's actually saying something about what bodies are that is impinging on us.
And it's acting on us. Mm,
On us.
You talk about some of your favourite writers and how they write about art and artists, and how some of them are professional critics, but not all of them are. Mm. And you also mentioned in your preface that you have a sort of suspicion that writing about art isn't taken very seriously. It's not proper criticism. It's more of an accompaniment, like a pianist playing for a singer. I wonder if you could perhaps say something about your sense of yourself as an art critic. I mean, these essays collected in this book, most of them you've been writing over the past nearly 30 years, I think. Mm-hmm. So how do you see yourself as a critic in that context?
Well, there is criticism which you can do, you know, in the daily papers or in a book, which is actually a critique. But there's also, and I think it's sort of rising as a form. Probably the technical word is ekphrasis, mm-hmm. you know, which is the Greek word for the living evocation of a work of art. And often those ekphrases actually imagine the work to be moving. I mean, the famous one is The Shield of Achilles, in which it actually seems to be like a film, and the battle seems to be taking place, and the shepherds are truly, you know, shepherding their flocks in this bronze shield. So in a sense, it's a communion with a different medium, with words, with the very stuff of the visual image. But the writers that I like, and I sort of, you know, feel are avatars, if you like, and I would like to be in their wake. They were actually very often poets. So it's sort of someone like Baudelaire, you know, was actually a professional art critic. I mean, he went to the Salon every year and did his, you know, resumes of who he thought was good. And that's actually a tremendous lesson in taste, because when you look up the actual paintings that Baudelaire singles out, you know, it's quite hard to think that these were the greatest paintings of the day.
Right.
Yeah. So it's got actually nothing to do with kind of, I mean, or rather what it shows you is that criteria of taste and appreciation keep changing, even for somebody who one reveres like Baudelaire. But Baudelaire was obviously also needing to look at art, not just to earn a bit of money, which he needed. And that's the same for some other art critics. I mean, John Ashbery, another great artist, a great artist in words, who made some wonderful, wonderful ecphrases, including his very long poem, Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror, that which is the poem that he takes off from the Parmigianino portrait. And then this is absolutely splendid. I mean, one of the most remarkable explorations of the idea of the self as seen in a mirror, how your features and your face relate to your inner being. This is an amazing poem. Well, he worked as an art critic for Newsweek. I mean, he was a regular Newsweek art critic. So, but for him, it was food. He needed to have that. He needed, literally, money, but also food, mind food, you know, to be in touch with that way of thinking, the visual way of thinking, on a pretty much weekly basis. And then, of course, there are some much older examples, like Diderot. Diderot was a very good art critic, and with lots of theories, and saw that as intrinsic to his thought and to his explorations. And then there are wonderful eccentric writers like Gertrude Stein, and Elizabeth Bishop, another one, who herself painted. So she actually tried to practiced as an artist as well. So it's there is a kind of family, you know, that, you know, very often when one writes, one wants to sort of belong to a family of the sort of the people who one likes reading.
You want to come out of a tradition.
And you want to be in sort of in conversation with people across time.
And that's your family.
That's a bit of my family.
In the book, you talk about how the first artist to ask you to write for her catalogue was Helen Chadwick for an exhibition she had on at the ICA in 1986. And you write very well about how, as a quite solitary writer at home, you really enjoyed interacting with her and talking to her in her kitchen and sort of spending time with her and getting to know her. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about how you relate to the artists you write about, what that means to you as a critic.
Yes. Well, I mean, I have made friends with several artists about whom I've written, often after being asked to write about them, so not ahead of time. It can be a bit daunting if somebody's a very close friend to be asked to write about their work. But I have made a number of, Kiki Smith is another. And Helen was, I mean, these are very remarkable people. So it is actually, you know, a huge sort of pleasure and inspiration to be near them. And Helen was very, very exceptional. I mean, she was extraordinarily well-read. And she read, I was thinking about it because I knew we were going to be in conversation. I was thinking, what is the difference between the way an artist reads and the way somebody reads when they're researching a book, like a biography? And of course, they're entirely following their instinct. Mm-hmm. They're not following a program of scholarship. They're going for things all the time. Because one of the general things one can say is that being with an artist to discover what they're doing with their work is always following a path of their discoveries, and that path will take one to many, many books. But the books are not like a reading list for a course. They're very different. They're very scattered. And they are, in a way, a map of their imagination as it travels. So that's very... And Helen was particularly in that. She was a very good writer, in a similar style to her own sculpture and her artworks. And I mean, she could have really written that essay herself. I ventriloquized a lot of her. I mean, I do acknowledge it.
But is that part of the process?
Yes, it is.
You need to be that close.
Yes, I mean, there's a, and it is, it's, it's an interesting form of friendship because actually people open up a lot to people they don't know. It's very strange. They almost more than, you know, you're there to listen and to understand, if you can, what's going on in the work. And they will open up a lot. And then, of course, when people do open up, you feel very close to them, unless you hate what they're saying.
Or you feel grateful to them.
Yes, yes. I mean, that has happened to me. I mean, I have had some slightly repugnant, but they're not in the book.
They didn't make it in.
It's not always a process of sort of loving identification. It can be quite different.
Yeah. Well, Paula Rego is in the book, and yes. I think you're quite close to
yes,
her.
Yes, but, yes.
I think over your entire writing career, you've been very interested in nursery rhyme and myth, and as an artist, she's obviously very connected to that world as well. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about her relationship with myth and fairy story.
Well, I first saw her work at the Serpentine when Alistair Warman curated the show in the 80s, and the striking paintings in that particular show were the Vivian girls, these delinquent girls, whom she had found in the work of Henry Darger, who's absolutely unknown really then, now very celebrated Chicago hospital porter, who's left in his room when he died a lot of extraordinary narrative fantasies about a band of girls defending themselves against hostile forces, mostly kind of... Anyway, it's an extraordinary epic. But she took the characters and she made these very free, very almost calligraphic, sort of fluent paintings. And I did find them very... I mean, I was very fascinated by them. But then, of course, she also had this body of very much more monumental, solid bodies in perspective of... a woman cleaning her father's huge jackboot. Mm. A young girl. And other scenes of very disturbing female collusion with systems of power. And some of the systems of power that Paula grew up with are not a million miles from my own background, because she was in Salazar's Portugal, and as a little girl, and my mother was born into fascist Italy in the south of Italy. And the worlds are quite similar. I mean, there's a presence in Paula's imagination of women in black who know things.
Mm.
They're often servants. They're on the fringes, but they're the ones who actually know, and they know above all about the dangers of life. In more recent work, she's done a fantastic protest series about reform of abortion laws in Portugal. And I think some of those memories are going back to her childhood when abortion was completely illegal and was performed by these women in black, in bedrooms and kitchen tables and things. So that world is the southern Italian world too. It's a very Catholic world, but it's also a militarized patriarchal world to do with the fascist systems. And so I felt, and Paula and I bonded over a very crazy thing, because she was very tongue-tied and shy in those early days of her fame. And we did a third Radio 3 interview, and she was very... But the moment the breakthrough had happened was when we discovered that we both as children had read this saccharine, sadistic writer for children called the Comtesse de Ségur, who wrote books called The Disasters of Sophie, in which Sophie was constantly being punished because she would go into the kitchen and eat a peach, and so she would then get beaten. And honestly, you can see it in Paula's paintings.
Yeah.
Really. But in those days, why I read Les Malheurs de Sophie and these related cruel books about girls was because I was at that stage in my childhood in Belgium, where she was, of course, the most recommended reading for girls. Also a background of colonial patriarchal Belgium, very strong Catholic collusion with colonial torture and so forth. Yeah, we share that. We have a twisted Catholic mind. So I've written a lot about her at different stages. I mean, in fact, I sort of combined some of the pieces in that one in the book.
Yeah.
But there are separate, different ones I've written over time, quite a lot.
When we met last week to talk about what we were going to talk about, you said something very interesting. You said that you thought that she made some of her work, for instance, the abortion painting series, she made these things to stop bad things from happening. Mm. And I wonder if you could perhaps talk a bit about that. Yeah.
Well, I think that's one of the functions of the active image, this idea of this Jellian idea that images are phosphorus. They actually do things. They're wildfire. In his Maori and Papua New Guinea studies, many, many of the art objects are made to ward off demons.
Mm.
And, you know, a lot of Catholic icons are made to ward off demons too. I mean, it's not... I mean, the crucifix is brandished in exorcism, exactly that function. And we don't sort of allow it or permit it because we think of Christianity as being an official religion and not a magical... But for me, I kind of agree with him, and I think there is a continuum between these things. Of course there is depth, and there is metaphysics, and there is spirituality and all the other things, but this function of the visual image to act as, the technical word is apotropaic,
mm.
to ward off danger, to ward off sickness, to keep the wearer or the user from harm. That is absolutely, and I think it's very strong in contemporary art. And one of the reasons, sort of skipping to the sort of last section of the book, one of the reasons that iconoclasm has become such an issue these days and is actually practiced by a lot of artists as well, is partly because of that, that the simulation of the breaking of something that is not liked is felt to have an impact on the world.
Mm.
It's probably not entirely... I mean, the immediate thing one would say is that it's not entirely true, but actually, that's moot. I mean, it is quite important what statements are made, visual statements as well as non-visual statements.
Your book contains a really strong essay on the feminist artist Kiki Smith. I didn't really know Kiki Smith until I read your piece and then I looked her up. I wonder if you could just, I'm sure most of you know her, but could you just describe her work briefly for those in the audience who might not know her work?
Mm, yes. Well, she's actually got a show coming up, which is going to be at Timothy Taylor.
Yeah,
very
I think
soon.
It opens tomorrow, I
yes,
think.
Yes, I think yeah. so, yes. Well, Kiki Smith is one of the artists, and there are quite a number of them. Louise Bourgeois would be another, who absolutely embraced many despised aspects of female materiality. So what she went for, Helen Chadwick also did that. So what she went for were many of the things that had been denigrated. She went for the flesh, for the menstruation, for pissing, for all kinds of, lots and lots of imagery of fertility and infertility. There is a whole strand of mourning in her work about not having children. She made, and it's often witty, it's very light. So sometimes there's a beautiful piece, a beautiful sculptural piece, rather Brancusi-like, made of glass, which is actually a kind of huge sea of sperm.
Mm.
So she liked using a lot of degraded materials, materials that are not usually considered noble. Though she has actually been making things in bronze recently. But her sculpture in the Frieze Sculpture Park now is bronze, but it's been painted with chalk. It's actually car paint and white car paint, but it looks like chalk. So she's actually debased the grandeur of bronze to make it look more material. And that is a sculpture of Alice in Wonderland called Alice Sear, S-E-W-E-R, Seer, and then brackets Alice. And Alice is sort of looking as if she's possessed, and she's holding out her hands as if she's sensing something.
Right.
So so Kiki is interested in the body as a medium for other kinds of knowledges that are not... So she's done Mary Magdalene. She's done Lot's Wife. She did a wonderful sculpture of Lot's Wife. So the Pillar of Salt, this sort of woman punished for looking back becomes a marvelous image of suffering, of female suffering, and the idea of memory, the idea of the woman who looks back is punished for looking back. But so here she is, this incinerated figure of memory.
Mm.
So there's a lot of echoes in her work of ideas of suffering, women suffering in the past. She takes archetypes, she takes characters, and she's done lots on the Virgin Mary. She also is a Catholic background.
A bit of a recurring theme
A bit of a recurring theme, yes. Kiki, I mean, is also important in terms of what I've tried to explore, because she's very playful.
Mm.
She doesn't have a studio. She integrates her entire practice with her life. So her kitchen table is full of sculptures that are half being made while she's eating. And she was brought up by her father was a famous sculptor, and her sister is an artist as well, Seton Smith. And her mother was a singer. And they were brought up not very well off at all. And the children were made to make models of the father's sculptures. So they did a lot of folding with origami.
Mm.
But she likes the idea that everything is in a continuum, that you're at the kitchen table, helping your father make his sculptures, and so forth. And she's continued that in her own habitat, even though she makes very large sculptures. But she also uses a lot of very light materials, like beautiful Japanese papers, and that are like cloth.
Mm.
So, yes, textile cloth, lace, glass.
Mm.
So she's taking the end of the spectrum that was considered craft, feminine, denigrated for that reason, and retrieved it. And actually so successfully transvalued it that many of you might not even recognize these as being denigrated materials anymore. Because, I mean, there's been such a return to, for textiles and craft work that actually it no longer feels sort of
like
marginal.
Like an inferior.
Yeah, it no longer feels marginal.
Mm.
But that's been an achievement of a lot of women artists, not only, but mostly.
So Louise Bourgeois is another artist who you write about really well in the book, and she obviously has done a lot with stitching and making, and her mother, I think, was a tapestry repairer. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. They used to have to restore the Cupid's genitals. Because the Aubusson tapestries had been censored.
Yeah.
So they were taken to the repair shop. It's an early memory and very, very influential on her. That as a child she saw her mother carefully re-embroidering the little penises on the Cupids.
And then she went on to have three sons, and she had to live with her husband, and and it became very significant for her.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just talk a bit about her childhood and. She had quite a unusual childhood.
Her work has made a tremendous story out of it.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit, I mean, actually, I sort of have a few caveats about it. But basically, the story is, and I'm sure many of you know it, that her father, who was rather a dandy, debonair figure, brought into the household an English governess who was actually called Sadie, and then to little Louise's. Louise felt that she should have been a boy. She was called Louise because if she'd been a boy, she would have been called Louis. And she always felt that she was very disappointing to her father because she wasn't a boy. And then she found to her absolute tragic sense of failure that he didn't love her, he loved the governess. So he not only had married her mother, but he also was having an affair with the governess, who was another love object in Louise's life. So she made in the 70s, and it went on for quite a while, a series of very splendid revenge mise-en-scène, which she cannibalized the figure of the father on a table wearing an extraordinary sort of goddess Kybele suit with many, many breasts. And I mean, it was baroque, it was mischievous, and it was very... very, very important to feminist rhetoric in art at the period. And why I have slight misgivings about it is I don't think it's her best work, one thing. But I also think that the Freudian narrative...
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's too strong. You know, it's sort of too neat. And I think it sort of comes out of Manhattan. In a kind of, you know, not entirely, well, not to me, well, it isn't quite sort of, it isn't quite fluid enough. It doesn't, yeah. doesn't have enough changes. But she certainly did make some wonderful pieces that were cells in which you look into a bedroom with mirrors. And then there, where it's less explicit than the Cannibal Feast on the father, you do get a sense of the mysteries of the parents' sex lives.
And quite very sinister, aren't they?
Yeah, very strong, yes. Mm. And then she said, you know, she had a prime symbol. She's a symbolic artist. And she, you know, had a very strong interest in that kind of material, in mythical material. She, people don't talk about this very much, but her husband was actually a kind of connoisseur of primitive art, and he was the curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art, Museum of Modern Art. I may have got the museum wrong, but anyway, he was a very important curator in New York and did some of the early exhibitions about primitive art and its relationship to so-called primitive art and its relationship to contemporary art. So she actually was very much in the world where people were thinking about that. And I think there's not been enough made of that in the discussion of her work. But to go back to her idea of the totem, for example, totems, fetishes, all these ideas that were circulating through the interest in African art, her totem is the spider.
Yeah.
And she saw her mother as a spider. She made, some of you may have seen at the Tate, huge spider, and several other spiders. She gives, underneath they have the eggs in a basket, in a glass basket, underneath the spider's legs. And she sees the spider as, of course, the great weaver, like her mother. And she said, you know, that when she was in a good mood, she would want to repair. But when she was in a bad mood, she wanted to cut.
Mm.
So she saw, this is the sort of work of the mother, the spider, who is both, you know, repairing and making this exquisite webs, but at the same time can be dangerous to the fly.
Mm.
So she used that as a kind of alter ego.
Mm.
She calls this series of sculptures of spiders maman, mummy. Mm.
Profoundly ambivalent.
Mm, yeah.
You say in the book that she had to wait a very long time to get the acclaim and recognition that she now has. Do you have any thoughts on why that recognition might have come so late on in her life?
Yes, no, I mean, it's comparable to Kiki Smith, and of course I didn't say the main thing is that they're figurative.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that was the elephant in the room. I mean, Kiki began doing completely figurative art, so did Paula Rego. Actually wanted to claim illustration as an art. Again, this is, you know, was kind of pejoratively seen as a sort of lower form, but she's always thought that Rowlandson, Gilray, you know, were a truly marvelously vigorous artists. Also, at the end of the 19th century, the French artist, Lautrec, is a very famous illustrator and poster designer artist, but there are lots of others who Paula very much admires. So similarly, Louise Bourgeois was... She was not sort of, you know, given the respect she was due, because even though she had this relationship to the symbolization of African art in many ways, she wasn't modernist. She just wasn't modernist. She had a relationship with surrealism, which was much appreciated, especially in America at that time. So, but I think that there was, I mean, the Guerrilla Girls did need to... You know, be gorillas.
Yeah,
they needed to be gorillas. Yeah. I mean, there was a general, and it's true in many other aspects of life too. I mean, things have remarkably changed. It's still not parity at all. and of course prices reflected.
Mm.
Even the greatest, I mean, not that I am one that actually supports the inflated state of the art market, but it is actually, you know, sort of wrong that a Tassa Dean is worth less than a Damien Hirst.
Yes, yeah. Mm. Talking about Tassa Dean, there's a really remarkable piece in the book called Footage, where you write about Dean's struggles with arthritis and her problems with walking and the impact that's had on her work. And I think we saw that in the recent Royal Academy show. I wonder if you might just talk a bit about that.
In a way, it's a very personal piece, and I, you know, did feel that I was, you know, sort of like putting big, heavy hands on somebody who's so delicate in many ways, such a very delicate sensibility. But what happened was that, you know, Tacita's rheumatoid arthritis was getting worse, and she was in lots of pain. And this is a long time ago, and I said to her, well, you know, actually, there are lots of wonderful stories in mythology and fairy tales about limping. And she said, oh, I want to know, tell me. So I wrote something for her about that, and she really liked it. It's a very, very strange corner of mythology. It's unbelievably deep. I mean, when you, Jacob wrestling with the angel in the Bible ends up with a withered hip. Cinderella loses her slipper. I mean, it's just extraordinary how much this idea of, you know, being set off balance by something happening runs in. And I'm not the person who invented this theory at all. It's Carlo Ginzburg, a great historian, wrote a famous book called Ecstasies, in which he says that it seems to be a kind of part of the lexicon of imagination and symbolism, that the sign of having crossed to the other side and come back is limping.
Mm.
So Oedipus limps. Anyway, that's the one story she took.
Yeah.
She took Antigone,
yeah,
and Oedipus. And she had found, when she developed this excruciating illness, she discovered that she'd had an interest in limping going right back to her childhood. She had drawings she'd made, and it was a wonderful story because actually she'd forgotten that she'd made these drawings.
Mm.
And then Delfina Foundation, where she'd had a fellowship when she was young, found a roll of old drawings by her and returned them to her in the 90s, I think. And she found in this roll of drawings she'd made way back, drawings of Oedipus and Byron.
Almost like a premonition.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oedipus and Byron, you know, another person who limped. So so she was really very spooked, but she has got this, you know, I mean, it's very strange. She has real extraordinary affinities. She can really, you probably all saw the clovers.
Yeah. You know,
she's, ever since she was a child, she's been able to find not only four-leaf clovers.
So five and six-leaf
clovers. And she just can see them.
Yeah,
and
she's got a sixth sense. Almost.
She's got,
yeah.
Yes. I mean, it's what artists often have, which is a, you know, an ability to respond to see things, and it is. But she does have it in a very, very marked sense.
Mm. Mm. Mm.
And then there's the other aspect, which is that she's very, you know, she says, I mean, she articulates that her theme is obsolescence. She's interested in things at the point where they are ceasing to be perfect. The buildings, I mean, she's done, you know, various, I mean, her wonderful early piece, Sound Mirrors, is about some war, there are these huge dishes that were used to, I think, to triangulate where the bombers were on the bounce of their sound. But she turned them into this monumental piece of photographs. But they're totally obsolete now. And so similarly, she's all the way along, the portrait gallery show, you know, many of her subjects were caught just at the end of their lives. I mean, they really are monuments, tributes to people on the way out.
Mm. And very sort of beautifully and slowly,
yeah,
done in
very
that way.
Done with,
yeah,
great tenderness,
yeah,
reverence, and of course extraordinary skill, beautiful luminosity, beautiful lighting.
Yeah.
I've asked you mainly about female artists this evening, partly because that's what I'm interested in too. But you do say in the book that the inner lives of women have always fascinated you. Do you think there is such a thing as women's art these days? Women's art as a separate discipline?
I think that I wouldn't want to make it separate, which is why I included male artists, because I didn't actually want to make a case that there was a... Because there are these themes of play and body, which are very much dominated by great creative women artists. The sort of themes of the book are also about how so many artists are preoccupied with making visible what can't be seen.
Mm.
And actually the phrase of making visible the invisible is Paul Klee. And so there are artists who have, male artists, who have been very, very, involved in this making manifest what is actually beyond our senses. And we don't even notice it because it's so intrinsic to art.
Mm.
We don't actually notice that we're being shown all the time things we can't see. And it sometimes can be quite technical, such as in an impressionist painting, it's simply the shadows, the famous coloured shadows. We don't see them because we don't have those eyes, but we can see them in the painting. That's a technical visibility. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, there are all the beings, Helen's, this love between this Baroque angel and which is herself, and the lamb. This is not something we are going to see, but it attains complete convincing reality. It attains being through the paint or whatever the medium is.
Mm. I'm aware that it's probably time for questions. Does anyone have a question for Marina?
Oh,
yeah. Sorry, could you wait for the mic? Thank you. For the people at the back.
Thanks. Thanks for that. I thought it was really interesting what you said about the image of the cannibalism in Louise Bourgeois being or feeling like it's sort of somewhat overly literal. And what do you think it is about symbolism that sort of seems to demand a level of obliquity, even when, as you said at the beginning of the talk, kind of art is full of content and narrative, in contrast to that kind of disinterested formal aesthetic? I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
I think that in the great danger when you're interested in symbolism and mythology, and that is that you, and actually allegory too, is if you sort of go for an exact match. I mean, I think this is not good for art in any medium. It's not good for writing. It's not good for... there's an example in art, which is Mantegna. Mantegna painted allegories, and they're rather stiff because they're too literal. There's evil is... wisdom is sort of being attacked by evil, and evil is... It's too sort of schematic. So... And then with mythology, it's also... And with symbolism too, it's also... Very, very important to me, at least, that the fluidity is permitted, that you don't think that this is a rigid, fixed meaning. There are schools of mythological interpretation which tend to affix a meaning. So, if you see an orange, it's going to be this, if you're going to see... And to some extent, Christian iconography does that too, but it's not. That's not where the interest lies, and certainly not for contemporary artists. For contemporary artists, where the interest lies is to keep pushing the values and the significance into another place so that we actually are refreshed and surprised rather than confirmed in our pre-existing ideas. If you want to be confirmed in your pre-existing ideas, you go to propaganda. So, and propaganda, of course, uses symbolism all the time. And probably advertising does too, but advertising is very difficult to see. It's so clever. It's very difficult to see how you're being manipulated, which is, of course, all our problems now. but an artist really does take up the language that is available and then tries to kind of move it into another place, which gives you a kind of shock and it can be negative, or it could be positive. So, so with the cannibalism piece, I think it was just perhaps a little bit too crowd pleasing. You know, it's sort of a very, I don't want to criticize her, but you know, when she does her beautiful diary, dreams, and all her inner, this wonderful, very fluid and loose, beautiful, personal, intense drawings of her states of mind, it's very different. It has a huge sort of opening up onto her horizon. It doesn't close things down.
How do you stretch your writing? You talk a lot about the artist's fluidity when they're taking on different subject matters, and I feel like your writing has some of that fluidity as well. Could you talk about your process and how you see the interplay between your writing and their artwork and what that means to you?
I suppose I'm endlessly interested in how something can have a huge hinterland of meaning in the past and feelings attached that actually has sort of gone and can be reactivated. I mean, an example, I suppose, from my own work, and certainly some of these artists are doing that, is simply the whole body of imaginative narrative. I mean, one of the artists, you know, here is Bosch, and I wanted to have Bosch in there because he's such a singular, singular imagination. And it's sort of inexhaustible, and we have actually, mostly we don't know what it means, which is in a way sort of interesting in itself. But, you know, the one in here is about the painting called The Haywain. And when I sort of went into what The Haywain could be, I sort of followed all the metaphors for hay and for straw and God knows why. And it's an incredible area, huge. I just scratched the surface of it. But it turned out that one of the dominant sort of things was really money. And so actually it worked very well as an for us now, this painting of people rushing to hell following this Haywain is an extraordinary portrait of the kind of, you know, like the crash, or which is the 10th anniversary now, just the general pursuit, you know, of the City of London. So it sort of works for us now, even though the language of it is pretty lost. I mean, in terms of biblical imagery of straws and hay. But it survives in some phrases that one uses. Building bricks with straw, for example. The hell is, in the painting, hell is being built with bricks with straw, i.e. it won't stand, won't hold.
What I wanted to sort of raise here is the sort of problematic or vexed question of medium. And you talk about Kiki Smith using, you know, denigrated materials, transforming them, and the way Paolo Rego uses paint. And, of course, Tassida Dean uses film, but in a kind of elegiac, sometimes quite nostalgic way.
Yeah, very.
And I wanted to ask you about, you know, a lot of artists now use video and photography. It would perhaps be the dominant medium. It's much more sort of disembodied than some of the work that you talked about. And I just wanted to know if you can say something about that sort of rise of video and photography as the kind of central medium of our
Alison
time.
Has just asked this question. Alison Turnbull is a very fine drawer and painter. And I very much, I mean, I'm sorry that I've just written an essay for Alison's book, so I'm sorry it was too late to get in this collection. But I think that sort of scrupulosity and attention is something I'm very, very attracted to. And also the spontaneity of drawing, the way that it has an immediacy. And it is like thinking. It's a kind of thinking with a different medium than just the mind. But there is a section of the book on digital media. Mm-hmm. Because I've concentrated on how digital media are very apt to express phantoms. So spectres, that actually this huge paradox of modernity, that our latest cutting-edge technologies are often used to produce the invisible and unimaginable, actually. So there's, artists who kind of evoke zombies and these kinds of states. And it started in the 19th century with photography. Photography was seen as a medium to see the invisible, and it's continued. And now the average child film, digitized, will have in it any number of complete figments. And they're not presented as figments. They are seen as real. I mean, and very convincingly, and sometimes fabulous. I mean, you know, the flying dinosaurs in the Utopia of Pandora in Avatar, fabulous. But they're not real, you know. They look real, but this is, and I think it's a very, very new condition of imagination that we are able to realize with such conviction that things that are figments. I mean, I think it's in other respects it's very dangerous. I don't go into this so much in this book, but because the whole hallucinatory landscape of news media, for example, is we have no idea how that's affecting us.
Thank you. Marina, you're such a tour de force, honestly. You just kind of sweep into all different kinds of intellectual ideas and the arts and religion, and it's a privilege to hear you speak. I was wondering where you're going next, because you've done religion, you've done art critique, and you've been doing it for a very long time, I think. Are you going to start on digitalization of art? Because somebody's got to.
Well, I am actually writing a book, so but it's about the refugee crisis. So the digitization comes into it a bit, actually, because there are aspects of the refugee crisis that have been affected very strongly by digital media reports. And actually, yes, I mean, and the push against it, too, is also driven by. So... But I've tried to look at... I mean, it's an example of looking at something in the past and sort of trying to uncover. I've tried to look at how different attitudes to the stranger, the arrivant, someone who arrives, are embedded in legal structures in the past. And in stories, there are just different, relationships to that. So it's partly about the law of sanctuary, the law which doesn't seem to be operating so much these days.
So they were kind of facts in people's lives.
Well, it's a major theme. It's a really major theme all through. I mean, it's Oedipus, who goes to Colonus as a petitioner after he's committed his terrible crime. So he's received and given sanctuary. Orestes, after he kills his mother, goes to Delphi to seek sanctuary. So that's in the Greek very strong. Then in Rome, it's even stronger with Dido and Aeneas, because Aeneas arrives as a petitioner for sanctuary. He breaks the law of sanctuary because he goes without telling her. So that's, so I'm trying to look at these ways that if we can draw out of the past a new kind of body of feelings and understanding mutual rights through these stories that enshrine the reception of the stranger at their heart.
Yes. Hi, thank you. I was just wondering about your choice of the word enchantment for the title of the whole book.
Well, I think that the idea of the active object, the artifact that has agency, is very much in the world of enchantment. I mean... it's not, of course, always a benign enchantment. Can be a malign enchantment, too. So it's not how enchanting, one enchanted evening. It's not quite that. it's a strong use. It's really, I'm sort of quite serious about it. I mean, I think that in words, too, I'm very struck by the
enshrining of hate speech in law. I mean, I think that I agree with it, but I think it actually shows that people do feel harmed by words when nothing has happened. And, you know, one does feel that. I mean, it's if you get, it doesn't, thank God, it hasn't happened to me for ages now, but, you know, dirty phone calls are extremely troubling. Mm-hmm. But why? You know, and that's because the idea of a verbal act has power. It just does. I mean, even though there is no actual cause and effect that's palpable, you can't measure it. And perhaps you can measure it in brainwaves or something, but you possibly can. Mm. So I think that, and of course, there have been the whole history of iconoclasm is all about a visceral response of viewers to the power of an image.
Because women's art and religion as a cultural thread as well as a theme of various kinds returns in your work and in the minds of all of us so frequently. And because you mentioned Louise Bourgeois and Maman, which was just outside Tate Modern a little while ago, it sort of travels around, right? Mm-hmm. It got me thinking about the differences that you might see and maybe even the parallels or the possibility for a really enriching conversation that you might see between, say, something which did happen, Bourgeois' Maman, outside Tate Modern, and something which could happen, Bourgeois' Maman outside Canterbury Cathedral. If and when women artists are working within and around and maybe troubling the waters of churches and cathedrals here and elsewhere, how do you think their artworks are being perceived or are enriching or working with those places?
The Anglican Church has been rather receptive, really quite sort of remarkably so, possibly because of the ordination of priests. I mean, it may go hand in hand with the fact that there are now, you know, many influential and apparently extremely good priests who are women. So that, I think, might have changed things. I mean, there are some very good artworks in churches now. I mean, I think the Hushiari window in St. Martin's in the Fields is absolutely wonderful. And that's even not, you know, she's not a Christian. So that was a fairly radical move on the part of that church, which, of course, is a radical church. I mean, it has a history of... So I'm quite impressed. I was once a judge of the ACE, the Art and Christian Inquiry Book Prize, and we were shown the works of art that were in contention for the art prize. And it was really very impressive. And I was in Salisbury Cathedral the other day to open the exhibition that Anna Maria Pacheco had. And her work is quite political. So, again, you know, it was very open to these thoughts by a woman and works. I mean, the other flip side of your question is what people get from encountering art, something that can perform some similar function to the encounter with the cathedrals of the past, which were so filled with beautiful art. And I think that, I mean, Alfred Gell certainly thought so, and I think there is an element. I mean, one of the things that the two pursuits have in common is that they are assemblies, and the assembly is quite important to the impact.
Ladies and gentlemen, yes, Marina Warner, Eleanor Byrne, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.